step by step, we're entering the Dharma gate of mind only. Opening the door into this strange world where nothing exists apart from mind. Nothing out there. So since we have some people arriving today to review a little bit, in a dream, when we're sleeping, dreaming, the situation we're in seems vividly real and not just an emanation of our mind. It's completely convincing in a dream, is it not? And when we wake up and review the dream, what seems very strange during the time of the dream doesn't seem so strange at all. And it doesn't seem like we're creating it. It seems to be an external world. So the mind-only school proposes that our waking life is virtually the same as a dream, that what appears to be an external world, separate from the mind, independent of the mind, is not so. Rather, it's much more like a dream. And though it seems pretty normal to us most of the time, like a dream does, actually, sometimes when we reflect deeper on our everyday life, it's also pretty strange. So the proposal of this school of teaching says that the perceiving mind and the perceived object arise simultaneously, that there aren't external objects out there waiting to be perceived. There aren't colors sitting there waiting for an eye consciousness. There aren't sounds out there waiting for an ear consciousness. When a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make any sound? Mind only would say, of course not. And it's not even that a color arrives a split second before an eye consciousness. They're completely simultaneous in this mode of understanding. In other words, they dependently co-arise. Means like dependent co-arising means there's no time difference. They're the simultaneous arising interdependently. It's not like this arises and then this arises dependent on that. Co-arise means together, exactly together, simultaneously. No, it's not like one thing is causing another thing. That's the beauty of dependent co-arising, is it's nothing's in charge. It's not a matter of the chicken or egg coming first. They dependently co-arise. And it seems that this kind of teaching is quite opposed to our usual way of thinking about the world. It seems like there was a Zendo here before we got here in the morning. When we're imagining coming here, we imagine that it's here and we know what it's going to look like. And when we get here, it seems to confirm our imagination. And yet, there's no way to actually prove that. There will never be any way to prove it. Now, you could say, well, what if we put a TV camera in here and recorded the Zendo at night and then watched the video during the daytime? It still wouldn't really definitively prove this, because we would be, as we were watching the video screen, that would be, you know, that visual object of the video screen would be arising at the same moment as our eye consciousness. So it sounds strange if we think that, well, is it really like there's nothing here? And then we arrive and suddenly it's here. And we all agree that the Zendo looks pretty much the same, even though part of the reasoning of this school is that we don't actually agree that it looks exactly the same. We all see the colors a little bit differently and so on. And from each of our places in the room right now, we see a slightly different angle of the room. But it's not so much saying that there's no basis for this mental image of a Zendo. It's a saying, if there's some basis for the mental image, we will never be able to access it. We can only access what we can perceive with our sensory apparatus and our mind. We'll only ever see the world, experience the world, experience the five senses or six senses through our own mind's filter. So if there's some objective basis for these perceived images, this school doesn't really get into that, because it's like that's something that is completely outside our experience. We'll never be able to experience it, and it doesn't really matter so much, because as a teaching of Buddha Dharma, what always matters is our experience. That's all we have to go on ever, is our experience. So rather than coming up with metaphysical ideas about how things might exist in reality beyond our experience, this school in particular, like, just doesn't go there. It's like, well, there's no particular reason to do that. So it's really very closely looking at our experience of the world. And in terms of our experience, the perceiving subject and the perceived object are one entity. There is the non-duality of subject and object in our experience. And that non-duality is the ultimate truth. And I think it's nice to look at this from different angles. So to say that the ultimate truth is the non-duality of the perceiving subject and the perceived object is the same as saying that the world we perceive is not external to mind. Does that seem clear? They're a little bit different ways of talking, but I think it's good to get all these different angles and see how they're the same. Or another way to say is, if we're talking about the emptiness in the mind-only school, it's the emptiness of separation between subject and object, the emptiness of a difference in entity between the subject and object, which is the same as saying the emptiness in the mind-only school is the emptiness of substantial reality of an imagined external world. which is substantially real and substantially separate from the mind that perceives it. So these are a lot of big words. I don't know if you can take them all in, but I think it's not such a complicated thing, but it's quite subtle point. But this, the metaphor of a dream is something pretty simple, I think, to approach this, seeing that the way the world actually is in the dream, it's completely convincing as an external world, is obviously, we know, created by the mind. It's a mental image, and therefore the world in a dream is one entity with the perceiving mind. That makes sense. There's a non-duality between mind and the world in a dream. And the school is saying that dreamlike nature of things is the way all things always are. And can you follow the point about how my perceiving mind and a perceived object dependently arise, that there aren't colors waiting to be seen, but that they, that an eye consciousness and a color come up together, and that's called an experience of a color.
Forgive me, I'm just coming into this. So my ignorance on about the display may have already been something you've talked about.
Well, I think it's good to review these things again and again. Are talking about that, I would say. And you say, of course they do, and that's how we all think, but according to this teaching, we actually don't say that, of course there's like animals walking around in the forest and sounds happening when trees fall and so on. Now, you talk about the human world, but also this applies to all six realms of sentient beings. So animals are included. Animals perceive worlds, so they, and in Buddhist cosmology, we have these other realms like hungry ghosts and heaven and hell beings that also do the same thing that humans do, is create the world. So, which is why in this, the classic, another classic metaphor of the mind-only school is the way these different beings perceive water that I talked about the other day. And I mentioned, you know, humans and animals, fish, but the, you know, without getting into the whole Buddhist cosmology thing, they also, in the original story, it's like, and hungry ghosts see water as blood and pus, and heavenly beings perceive water as ambrosia, and hell beings perceive water as fire. So these are kind of metaphorical examples, but It's that these are all sentient beings of samsara, the six realms, but so it's not just humans, that's part of it. Any sentient, we call sentient beings or living beings, that they all create an illusion of an external world. And this example of the water is a good one for showing how that's so. And now we say, so maybe another way to rephrase your question too is in terms of the water thing is like, we say, well, they all see it differently. Just forget about the hungry ghosts and hell beings and stuff, but just fish and people see this water, perceive this water, relate to this water completely differently. And then the question might be, well, of course, it's really water, though. But maybe is that another way to say?
Well, okay, can I...
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about fish.
Yeah.
What fish?
Well, you know, for us, fish aren't really out there either.
Well, see, this is the thing. I mean, even in what you're describing, there's this acknowledgement of these different realms, yes, and these different realms perceive water differently. But, okay, so what different realms? You know, if I take this to the logical, where it feels like to me, this way, like really just narrowly falling, like, well, there's no fish, there's no animals, there's none of that.
Yeah, in the end.
We are talking about using them as examples of other beings that
Water. Well, and all these words, this whole story, this whole, everything we can say or think about our life, and I think we do take it to the logical conclusion, all of this is mind only, or another way we've been saying, talking about it, that it's said is, all this is mere concept. And yet, we're using all these concepts and unreal things, like talking about fish and water and stuff, it's all actually made up, but it's made up stories that hopefully can be helpful to unravel our grasping things as more than made up stories. So we do have to go down into the mud of talking about fish and things like that in order to get to the point of seeing that there actually aren't fish, or fish are our mind, which is maybe quite clear now because we're thinking about fish, but we don't see any fish in the room, so they're obviously, any fish that we're conceiving of right now don't even seem to be like apart from the mind, because they're right now any image of a fish is totally our imagination. But like this book seems different than the fish in our imagination, and this school is saying, no, it's the same. As a fish that we're imagining that's gold and swimming around in our mind is ultimately no different than a perceived physical kind of thing here. And the point about, well, obviously there really is like a forest and animals out there apart from humans. Again, we're not saying that there's nothing. I think it's important to say, to not go to the so far into the extreme that there's nothing out there, we could say, or like the basis for our designations of like forest and animals, that there's no basis. We could say there's a basis for designation, but in that realm, we can only think of it, how to talk about this, we can only think of it in terms of like we have an image of a forest with animals running through it, and like it's immediately labeled as all those things in it. And we can't even imagine, like, we imagine, right? We imagine that if we were like a tiger running through the forest, we imagine our human mind in the tiger, like, this is cool, I'm running through the forest, I'm a tiger, and like, look, there's a tree. But actually, if we look deeper, we know that actually tigers don't say, look, there's a tree, don't even think. It's completely different realm. We have no idea what it's like to be a tiger, except we can kind of deduce that they seem to do this projecting an external world in the same way that we do in order to like eat this thing and not this thing and so on. But I'm just kind of playing around with this, and maybe we'll see if Nanette can help.
I'm going to offer my energy soup because I can conceive of is an inconceivable kind of cosmic energy soup arising and ceasing on every moment that through my little sticky, you know, karmic consciousness, I make into whatever I make them into. And you make them into what you make them into. And there's things that we don't, so much that we don't even perceive, it's also doing its cosmic soup. So it's there, but the mind, it's like what we create is everything, to me, is all the world that we live in. And we live in, I think I live in this world, tiny slice that I can perceive and categorize and think about and touch. So that's...
I think that works is it's like a it's a soup. What kind of soup again?
Energy
soup. It's an energy soup. Yeah, we were talking about this yesterday, and I was saying, and it's like this soup is so steamy that you can't even see the surface of it. You can't even see what kind of soup it is. You just see all the steam rising up. And so these are all images, just like all the, we can't quite get at it. So, but I think that can be helpful. As soon as we make it, have an image of it's this kind of soup, then we're already doing that again. But anything we say is doing that. So we have to use words, but it might point us in the direction of, yeah, there's a kind of undifferentiated, inconceivable, I think is the key point. It's not like if we were smarter or more perceptive or more present, we could conceive it. It's by definition, it's inconceivable to even a Buddha. Because as soon as we conceive it, then it's a conception. It's our own version of it.
And
it's changing. Yeah, it's like a soup. It's not a fixed thing. It's constant. It's not like it's reality in this almost godlike way that's never changes or something. It's like another way to talk about it, to call that soup is dependent co-arising. It's the way everything is interdependently arising with everything else, inconceivably and ungraspably, but that's far from nothing. It's not that there's nothing. So when I say we think that there's a zendo here before we come in, it's kind of being careful with words to say there's not a zendo. Is there like a cosmic soup before we come in here? Yeah, we could say it like that, but you know, that's another idea. But I think it's important that it's in this soup there aren't zendos. Or another way my teacher sometimes would say this is, the world doesn't come in packages. Packages meaning like book stand, book, ton, cushion. We immediately open our eyes and it's like a packaged world of like everything is like all these separate things. Before we even name them, it's like we distinguish borders between things. But actually, that's just our perceptive mind just immediately packaging the world into all these different things, but when it's prepackaged, it's like the soup. It's like it's inconceivable, dependent, co-arising, and like, yeah, nature. I think when we're out in the woods where there aren't humans around, we were still doing this, perceiving everything as an external world. We maybe start to open a little bit more to the way that there's something going on here beyond like what I can understand. How did this all happen? And I'm part of it. Yes.
I was wondering, like, when you said there's something about a fish, then I see a fish jump into my mind on the lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think I was wondering maybe the name of that lake is the Lila Vietnam. And then the discussion about when you're reading the book and the content of the book is in the mind, well, where's the book?
Yeah, well, another way of saying, and also it's an interesting point that when we just say the word fish, immediately we're going to get what, how many, 9 or 10 completely different images of fish, just when we say that word, or book, or whatever. But yeah, alaya vijnana, we haven't.
Is that where we also abide at?
What?
In the alaya vijnana.
Yeah, so alaya vijnana is the storehouse consciousness, and this is going to be the first chapter of this sutra in this class we'll get into. I'm kind of refraining from getting into the sutra because I don't want to jump ahead into the class, but this is all setting the stage for it. But the storehouse consciousness is another way of talking about the soup. Nanette's soup is because the storehouse consciousness is the it's an inconceivable storehouse of every cause and effect relationship that's ever happened, you know, to us, you know, to, it's kind of individual in a certain way. I mean, it's not like there's one, ultimately we could say there's one mind, but conventionally it's like every sentient being would have this storehouse consciousness, and that's like their personal set of dependent co-arising, and it's all the karmic conditioning. It's particularly, it's like a storehouse of karmic patterns. And so that's why, when we say fish, you see a particular fish jumping out of a particular lake and it's blue or whatever. That's the way your storehouse consciousness has stored images of fish. We have lots of different ones, and it's, you know, you can imagine in this idea of a storehouse consciousness how vast it is. And it's registered images of probably millions of fish images throughout your whole life. But like, that's the dominant one at that moment, you know, because of the color of the sky right now, that reminds you of this one fishing trip you went on at 10 years old or something. So that's the one that came up at this moment. Now, if it was nighttime, you imagine some kind of night fish maybe. And other people, their storehouse consciousnesses would give rise to all different images. So we could never get into this storehouse consciousness.
Came up was one that lived in my memory from the
past. Yeah. Or some combination of, you know, might have been an exact fish that you saw.
Are we swimming in the ocean of Ayurveda and not like a fish swims in the water?
It's not so much, well, what do you mean by we? It's like, it's more like there is just the ocean of alaya vijnana. There's no me. You could say the me, it's not so much that there's me swimming in my alaya. It's more like there's alaya, and one of the things, one of the main things in this alaya means storehouse, or storehouse consciousness. One of the things in there is that's very important is the conception of me. Of a self is a big thing that strongly flavors this soup. It's like super hot chili peppers. That like all, there goes the tenzo.
I vowed that after the soup was mentioned one more time, I would check the soup.
But it's like, there's all these other flavors of, you know, that include different kinds of fish that we saw and stuff. But maybe the main flavor in the storehouse consciousness, like the hot chili that dominates all other flavors, is this sense of me. Because, in a way, like all the other things are related to me. It's like, I went on that fishing trip and I remember that fish, and all of it's registering as this happened to me and that happened to me and to me, 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 me. And so, when we get into the sutra, there's this seventh consciousness too. You know, we call the storehouse the eighth consciousness. The seventh consciousness is kind of like the me consciousness. It's like the,
what if every guppy in the school identifies himself as me, but also as a member of the school of guppies? Like we identify ourselves,
yeah,
as an individual.
Well, they probably do. I mean, yeah. But all of that is mere concept. You know, however we and the guppies identify themselves.
What if the guppies looking outward, and so doesn't really see a me, but it sees
Well, that's part of the thing, is like if we look outward and see like a book out here, or another guppy or something, that's like, that's a, suddenly we have a dualistic experience. And you could say, well, really, just we don't see me, we see the book. But it's implied that, again, this is the dependent co-arising of subject and object. So it's like, as soon as we see the book, we don't think, oh, it's me seeing the book. But that's what's actually implied. If we look deeper, as soon as we see an external book, that's the same moment as there's me. We don't maybe consciously think there's me, but that's called a dualistic experience, which is self and other. And, getting back to the overview here, that's the origin of suffering, according to the school. But as soon as there's this split of subject and object, and an external world perceived as truly external to mind, that's where all the trouble begins. Because then we have, like, it's a book, and if you, like, try to take my book, I'm like, that's my book. And, like, or even if you don't take it and it just starts burning up or disintegrating, but it's my book. And, like, you know, I think it's not me. Anything I think is not me, my relationship to it is going to be problematic. And so this is the point of these teachings, is the freedom from the suffering. All Buddhist teachings are about freedom from suffering, and this is this unique innovation, this mind-only school to approach this. Just one second, I just thought of one more point, is that the fact that it's separate is the basis for like all the trouble. Sometimes we don't feel so troubled, but it's a little bit awkward and painful to live in a world that seems separate. Even when things are going well, it's a little bit off. Whereas if we just open even slightly, and I'm proposing in a session like this, we can open to a little bit, even in a limited conceptual ways, this dreamlike quality of how the world is not outside ourselves, and each other people in particular. And that's where, even for just a moment, this is a kind of an imaginative thing, but you can do it when you're especially outside, well, especially during zazen, and especially not during zazen, when you're walking around, you can like, what if I'm like, the mind is creating all of these colors. It's not really like this. This is my version. And other people, I find if we open to that even slightly in our kind of clunky and, you know, confused kind of way, that as sentient beings, that we can even approach this kind of thing, I think that's the realm of like deep intimacy. So the side apart from suffering is like when we're really like, these people are actually me. You know, they're not these other people out there. I mean, they're not in my control. And they're because this is dependent co-arising. Everything is completely out of control. But the way that like we're co-creating each other, perceptually, you could say, is actually almost excruciatingly intimate, if we're really open to that. Terrifyingly intimate. Because, like, we are like, there's no separation, right? So, yes.
Ignorance here. Originally I was going to ask, then is there a Buddha? Buddha just creation of mind only, and then about Buddha images maybe. And you know, their teachings say that we're all Buddhas to be, and there are innumerable Buddhas. So I might go that way. But what I really want to ask is there a Dharma, or is Dharma mind only? Is it only a concept that we have?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because there is this early teaching that comes to mind from the Pali Canon, where the Buddha's talking about the Dharma. Well, one place he says in the early teachings, when you see dependent co-arising, you see the Dharma. And basically he equates dependent co-arising with the Dharma. And then he says, I as the Buddha have come across this ancient path. Like he uses the metaphor like a path through a forest. And he's like, there's this overgrown path that's been lost for like eons of time since like Kashyapa Buddha, I guess we'd say. And I've discovered this ancient path. And he says in this particular intriguing sutra, I think, he's like, this path, it's like, whether or not there's Buddhas in the world, this path is here. It gets overgrown, but it can be discovered and accessed at any time, but it's very rare that this happens. This is when a Buddha appears in the world. And that sutra is kind of like almost implying that there's this true Dharma that's not just mind only. That there's like a Dharma that exists when there's no living beings in the world, and then when living beings come, it is kind of waiting for them to discover. That sutra sounds kind of like that. And yet, the Dharma that we can conceive of, if we're talking about that's dependent co-arising, the Dharma we can conceive of is like these teachings, these like verbal or written teachings and our thoughts about them. That part is mind only, or mere concept. But it's like about, all these words are about this inconceivable reality that is that mind only. Or another Zen story about is the Dharma mind only? This maybe would apply. It's in the Koan collections. The question is, the student comes to the teacher and says, at the giant firestorm at the end of the universe, when everything is destroyed, you know, when the entire, this is part of Buddhist cosmology too, that there's these cycles of arising and destruction over long kalpas of time, that universes arise and cease, you know, way beyond time that we can think of, like this universe arose and it will be destroyed at the end. And they describe the fire and all the great elements just basically destroying like the physical material universe and of course all the living beings in it. And so that's this old story. So this monk, Zen monk, is saying, referring to that story and saying, when the whole universe is destroyed at the end of the kalpa, is this destroyed or not? You know, and I think we say this refers to this inconceivable soup. We could say, is the soup destroyed? When the whole universe is destroyed, is the soup? And the soup is like, also I would say, and if we're talking about, if Vilaya Vijnana is the soup also, it's not just physical. In fact, technically speaking, it's not physical at all. It's mind soup. But is, you know, and it's radiant, inconceivable life, right? When all the like planets and stars are being destroyed, is this destroyed? Is this interdependent, arising, frothing suchness destroyed or not? And the teacher says, It's destroyed. Well, I think there's different versions of the story. One is that it's destroyed, and the student says, "How could that be?" And the teacher says, "It goes along with it." In other words, in this non-dual soup realm, it's like the whole universe is part of it. It's not like there's a soup apart from the physical universe. So when the universe is destroyed, or we're saying, we could call it mind even, is like Buddha mind destroyed or not, it goes along with it because it's not something separate from the planets and stars and stuff, which is kind of neat. And then I think there's one version, as I recall, where another monk comes and asks the same teacher the same question, is it destroyed or not? And he says, it's not destroyed. Just for good measure. because, and I can't remember how he put that.
Maybe because of the interpretation of the different viewers. But I was thinking, like, say the Buddha is sitting there and he's in his empty state of mind, and he looks out over a bunch of people, and he like sees the Buddha, and the Buddha has an empty mind. So he doesn't, this would be a visiting, no thought arises. Then another person enters the vicinity. They're not enlightened, but they're not really a big person, they're fairly intelligent. So all of a sudden, a dharma arises for this person's conceptualizations. And let's see. Oh, I kind of lost it. The second dot. Like all dharmas are non-dharmas. But this person is conceptualizing the Buddha. Perceives that conceptualization. So now there's a being. There was no being until there was this interaction between the Buddha and the stranger. So now there's a dharma.
Well, another thing this brings to mind is we talked about yesterday the two truths. So like the conventional and ultimate truth. So is the dharma mind only? In one way, you could say the ultimate dharma is that's called emptiness, ungraspability. In this mind-only school, it's called the thoroughly established character of all phenomena. That is beyond our conceptions. In that sense, it's not just mere concept. Until we put a word on it, and then it's like, then it's, that's called conventional truth or conventional dharma, and that's just mere concept.
It's something, the dharma is something that exists independently of sentient beings?
We could say the ultimate truth, not the one that's called the ultimate truth, but the one that's not limited by the words of ultimate truth, even. Is it independent of sentient beings? Well, it kind of gets into semantics, maybe. It's hard to talk about because any way that it could possibly be useful to us to access it or to live in accord with it or talk about it, then immediately it's dependent on sentient beings. Maybe it's safer to say that actually there can't be even an ultimate dharma independent of sentient beings. That actually, it's good to, I mean, basically this system, this mind-only system is that. It's a system, and it's a construction, it's a mental construction that a lot of people very skillfully put a lot of effort into working out a lot of the kinks, and so it's to make a really solid system, a really well-functioning system. But that's what it is. So as we're doing this, all of this is just, we're creating this imagination. It's like, we're creating an imaginary world of mind only that's about, and this world is all about imagination and how imagination works. So it's a strange thing to be doing. But the very thing that it's doing maybe I said yesterday something like, it's self-destructive by nature. It's like, it's creating the system that's going to self-destruct. It has to, or else we'll be stuck in the system. But I think if we don't have a system, it's like a really good self-destruction device. It's like without some really good tools, we won't destroy everything. You know, like we need really good clean fuel to like burn this fire completely so there's nothing left. Another great image I think of around this kind of thing, right? You might have heard this. It's like we're creating this like Dharma fire, or this awakening kind of fire, and we're constructing it from all this stuff, and we're it's burning up the fuel that it's burning, the wood that it's burning is all the concepts of everything. So we're burning up all these concepts, and we're using this stick to kind of tend the fire and like push all these concepts back into the center of the fire. As they fall at the side, it's like they start smoldering, and we start attaching to them because they're not burned up. Oh, push that one back in. And this stick is like the mind-only system. We're like pushing it all into the fire, and we keep, in the end, when we got everything in there and it's all burning really well and we know nothing's going to fall out, then we have to throw the stick, the stick that's doing, and that's gate. So, which is also similar to these three types of wisdom that I also, as a review from yesterday, right? We first hear the words, the wisdom from hearing or reading Dharma, right, is like the stick, really getting a good hold, a good grasp on the stick, and understanding what the words mean. First, just that level, just understanding, and in this kind of teaching, it takes a lot just to understand what the words are even meaning. And then the second type is reflecting on them, like, okay, now we got the basic, I understand what it's saying, but I don't necessarily agree with this. So then we're like, start turning it over in our own experience, and like, could this work? And then that's where we bring up all the questions, and I think it's very helpful to have the discussion. And in the end, the wisdom of actually becoming such a teaching, and that's like throwing this last stick into the fire. It's like all the ideas that we've heard and even reflected on, in the end, all of it is we let go of all the conceptual constructs and just be this non-duality of subject and object in Zazen. I keep bringing this book every day, and I haven't opened it yet, so I'm determined to do so today. No, we'll bring it tomorrow. This book is Dogen's extensive record, the Eihei Koroku. Dogen wrote, we have these, the Shobo Genzo, that's bigger than this even. That's Dogen's more like written essays on different topics in 95 chapters. And then these are like recordings of more informal, but maybe we shouldn't say informal. They're just recordings of live talks, and they're very short, like usually a paragraph. So it's kind of embarrassing to give such long talks, because it seems like Dogen's were about 30 seconds long. Unless they just, this is the, maybe they just recorded their favorite part out of the middle of an hour talk. We'll never know. But there's a large collection. And the Shobo Genzo is mostly Dogen wrote and present, he wrote and then actually presented as Dharma talks, it looks like, for the first maybe half of his teaching career. And then the later years, he stopped writing so much, and these recorded talks were more closer to the end of his life. He started doing a lot more of this style of very strange talk. And he's often, in both cases, Shobo Genzo and Eihei Koroku, he's often bringing up Zen stories, classical Zen koan stories, and commenting on them. In the Shobo Genzo, very elaborately, and here more concisely. So here he brings up a story. And he, it begins with there's a quote from the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, is sometimes considered a basis for the mind only, but in the book that's about this thick, it's like one sentence, really, that's referring directly to mind only, but it's often quoted, interestingly, because I think it's such an important sutra, maybe why, but in that sutra, the Buddha says, the three realms are mind only. So he uses this term, mind only. The three realms are, again, Buddhist cosmology saying the whole world of apparent reality, the world of samsara and confused beings comes in these three forms of, you know, the desire realm, which is the realm that we live in most of the time, where desire is the dominant factor, or you could say some dissatisfaction with the way things are going is like kind of like running throughout our lives. And then the form realm and the formless realm are the other two, and those are like these meditation realms from form and formless dhyana practice, where they're just very refined states of mind. And I think that when they say, when they're talking about the three realms, we have, when we do Sajiki ceremony now, we have this tablet on the altar that says myriad spirits of the three realms. It's just like covering all the bases. It is saying there's these spirit beings and that there's sentient beings. Not only, we maybe never access the form and formless realms, but they're just saying even these exalted meditation heavenly realms, there's still samsara. And that's the point that's being made. And then, so when the Buddha says the three realms, even these really refined meditation realms where there's barely any duality or suffering, it's still, the seeds for samsara are still there. So the three realms are mind only. That was like a famous quote from the Flower Ornament Sutra that people seem to know in the Zen realm in the old days. So Dogen says, here is a story. It's just a story, like everything he ever said. Xuanzha asked Luohan, his student, the three realms are mind only. How do you understand this? Dogen also has a chapter in the Shobogenzo called The Three Realms Are Mind Only, where he quotes the same story. The three realms, or the triple world, is mind only. How do you understand this? And Luohan, the student, pointed to a chair and asked Xuanzha, teacher, what do you call that? And I imagine, in my conceptual image of this, that the chair is like this ceremonial chair that we sometimes use. We'll bring it out for the Par Nirvana ceremony. And it's, you know, it's wood, but then it has this latticework seat. And I was hoping that Rob would be here so I could ask him as a carpenter if they ever make those wicker seats out of bamboo. Does anybody know that? Or is it generally like just peels of bark or something? Anyway, for the sake of this story, as you'll see, I'm imagining that there's a wooden chair with this bamboo wicker seat. Yeah, like be really thin strips so it's flexible. Yeah, have you ever heard about weaving bamboo seats like that?
Yeah, there's one on that bamboo giant, like a swing.
Ah.
I was checking it out.
Huh.
It's
because it's flexible, so I think it might be nicer than wood because it creates a somewhat cushioned seat. That's the idea of wicker chairs, right? Or maybe it's not even, maybe wicker is like straw. Anyway. What do you call this? He asked the teacher first says to the student, the three worlds are mine only. How do you understand this? And the student says to the teacher, points at a chair and says, what do you call this, teacher? And the teacher says, chair. And the student says, you don't understand that the three realms are mine only. So the student kind of like counter parries, right? And so, as we've been talking about, you know, as soon as we label something, you know, that's a chair, this whole thing of creating an external world greatly depends on language and words, and as the sutra will make clear. So, that's a chair. But in the soup, right, there are no chairs. And there's no, even, you know, there's no chairs. So the student says, "Teacher, you don't understand that the three realms are mine only." And then the teacher points to the chair and says, "I call this bamboo and wood. What do you call it?" That's why I like to think that this chair was made out of bamboo and wood. So, you know, we might say, "Oh, it's wood and screws and varnish." That's starting to break down our idea of a chair, right? In terms of like, oh, we could, you know. In fact, a carpenter might look at that chair and somebody says, "What is it?" They immediately see it as a particular kind of tree and varnish and a particular design, you know. And then, oh, of course it's a chair, but they see, you know, we perceive it in different ways. A termite would see that chair as food. A physicist might say something, yeah, that it's...
It's a question of matter frozen in time and dissipating.
Yeah, and it's chairs have been designed since ancient times with four legs because of the physics of gravity. If you took off one of the legs, gravity would pull it off to the side and it wouldn't be comfortable to sit on. So, and people who didn't know our tradition of wall gazing might think it's strange that the chair is facing the wall. So, and people from there are cultures that don't have chairs in this world, of humans even. I think very few probably left in the, you know, rainforests of Africa or something, and they'd probably never seen a chair, and they would probably see it as some kind of tool or something, I don't know.
A ladder.
So the teacher says, when the student says, "You don't understand mine," and then the teacher like changes his answer. Says, "Okay, I call it bamboo and wood. What do you call it?" And the student says, "I also call it bamboo and wood." And then the teacher says, "If you search the entire great earth for one person who understands the Buddha Dharma, nobody can be found." So you could hear that as like a criticism, like, you don't get it, really, like, you don't understand in the end. But, or you can hear this as a mind-only teaching, that if you search the whole earth for one person, a person, or a chair, or a fish, right? Not one can be found.
Not one person.
Nothing actually can be found. If you search in the soup for a person, you won't find one. We do find them with our conceptual thinking, but in actually, if we're completely just swimming in the soup, no people, chairs, fish, or chili peppers can be found, actually.
What?
Right? It's just undifferentiated soup. I think that's why Ninette likes to call it soup, because you can't distinguish all the different pieces in the soup, right? It's like, it's just like, it's made up of all these things, but it's like mush. How about like split pea soup that's like way cooked, so it's like really mush. You can't see any particular pea anymore, and the carrots are totally broken down. It's indistinguishable soup. So
it.
Yeah, so we have, you know, you could even skip the Buddha Dharma. If you search the entire great earth for one person, nobody can be found. But he's kind of relating it back to, you know, this question of how do you understand this, and they're talking about Buddha Dharma. So if you search the whole great earth for one person who understands the Buddha Dharma, nobody can be found. So it's like, not only can a person not be found, a person who understands Buddha Dharma can't be found, and a person who understands that the three worlds is mind only can't be found. There's many different levels you could say going on here. A person who understands Buddha Dharma, who understands that soup, I think that's what we're referring to as that the three worlds as mind only is the soup. Right? So if you, not one person can be found who can understand the soup, it's inconceivable by definition. No one can ever understand such a thing.
If there was such a person who would seem to understand it, that they would see that they were part of the soup and they weren't isolated.
And if they saw it that way or understood it or knew it in that way, then as soon as they know it, they'd be outside the soup. One moment of knowing plummet them right out of the pot. like there's just a little potato swimming around in the split pea soup, and as soon as it's like, oh wow, I'm just a potato swimming, whoop, they get ejected from the soup. And then they're outside and they're like, I just want to go back to the soup and just stew in there. It's so warm. And just, you know, everything's included in there. Now I feel like outside, and now I'm like looking in at the soup and I can't see through the pot. It's like surrounded by this like impenetrable stainless steel pot with the lid bolted down. We can't see in there.
The broth would be made up of the individual's ancestors, and their destiny would be to be consumed.
Yeah, they're consumed, but as soon as they as soon as they say, I'm the 92nd generation ancestor in the soup pot, they're ejected.
Not rejected, not accepted, just following the way.
Well, but as soon as we define it and know it and define ourselves as some, even to say, I feel so happy to be a part of the whole, even in the slightest way, we're suddenly not part of it anymore, you know. Ultimately, we are part of it. Ultimately, we can't be ejected from the pot, but the illusion of ejection is, or rejection from the pot immediately arises as soon as we know it.
If you understood the Dharma, you would understand that you weren't.
What's that?
If you understood the Dharma, you would understand
it. But if we have to understand it in a non-conceptual way, if we understand, yeah, I'm actually empty, that's just like dualistic constructs.
You couldn't even conceptualize it.
Exactly. You couldn't. As soon as we conceptualize anything, we separate from the soup. It's like the myth of Amor and Psyche. You know, this, the Greek myth. Isn't it something like, I forget which is which.
Psyche was the god, I think.
Psyche was the god, and Amor wanted to know him.
So.
Right? So they're living there. It was like an arranged marriage, maybe. Mm-hmm. Right? So, like, Amor can live with Psyche. And this is right, like, maybe we could even say Amor is sort of like the soup realm and the love, the soup of inconceivable love, right? And Psyche is like knowing what's going on, and total intelligence, but dualistic knowledge. And so they have this, I don't know the myth enough to tell it clearly, but I'll ad lib. It's like they have this arranged marriage, and so that they can live together, but the one rule that Amor has to live with Psyche, who is known to be this incredibly beautiful guy, is she can't, they live in the dark, in this dark underworld or cave or something, and she can't see him. And the deal is, if she could see him, you know, like visually see him, they'll have to separate. She'll lose him. So she agrees, and they live happily and peacefully in this, in the soup, in the loving soup. But then she keeps hearing all these stories about how beautiful he is. She'd really like to just one look at him, please. just one look. I'll never look again. I'll just, then if I have one look, then I'll be able to remember, right? Then I can just have a mental image. That's good enough. I don't need to keep looking. Just one mental image. You know, one visual image. One, you know, some way to get a hold of this guy. And isn't it something like she lights a candle or
something? There's some way that she sees it.
A lamp. Does she light it or does someone give it to her? Maybe she lights it, right? It has to come from her own free will. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get a hold of the potatoes in the soup. And so she lights a lamp, and immediately she ejected from this world, or else he flies off. Immediately flies off. I can't remember the detail, but they're separated. And of course, then she more like, I didn't need to do that. We were living together so peacefully and happily, joyfully, just in love. But I couldn't stand it. I had to like see him. Yes. And then later, of course, the part of the myth is she pleads to be reunited with him, and she gets to go through all this work. She's given all these tasks by her mother or something to fulfill in order to reunite with Psyche. And that's why, that's like this class. This mind-only class is the hard work. It's like doing all this stuff in the conventional world.
I wonder if what made him so beautiful or whatever was his qualities. The words that he chose
there. Yeah, like maybe it really wasn't what he looked like. You mean?
Well, that's what she saw in him. She saw that he was kind. She saw that he was thoughtful.
Yeah, so she knew, maybe she knew these kind of more hard to define qualities, but she wanted the really definable one. She wanted a visual perception.
She could light a candle and see that he was just like many other guys have
seen. Yeah, and I think in the story, it'd be nice to go back and look at this myth. I think in the myth, he really is like magnificently beautiful. She's like, for this one second, she's like, oh my God, like, way better than I imagined. But then he's gone, you know. Interestingly, he could have been like really ugly or something. That would have been an interesting part of the story too. But I think it really did kind of confirm. And maybe this is like, I don't know, like, in Zen, we might talk about like Kensho or something. It really is like more beautiful than I thought, but like, and I got it. And as soon as like you get any experience and like get a hold of it, it's like gone. Like, please, I want to go back. Yes.
Well, as you're bringing the mythological world in here, I'm thinking there's actually a teaching story that's the opposite, which is Beauty and the Beast. Because in Beauty and the Beast, everybody's rejecting. Because she can see that he's ugly, he's a beast. And actually it's when she's willing to not go by what she's seeing and what everybody perceives, which is that he's this horrible beast, and trust her heart, which you could say maybe is the undifferent, is the soup.
Yeah, beyond the perceptions.
Yeah, then actually that's the transformational piece in that little love story.
Definitely sounds like a mind-only story, though.
It's the opposite.
Because it's about perception.
Shrek goes to the other room, where they go, the princess has to become ugly.
There you go.
And they both end up ugly, but they have love.
So you've got three different sides. They all point to how our constructions of an imagined world cause great suffering and joy.
That's exactly what it all proves.
Yeah. So it is the basic thing. Yes, Patrick.
Do we have to?
No.
I'm jumping away from the myth. I'm just thinking about my holy school. Do we have to sort of say that the Zendo doesn't exist to really be mind only? Can't we just say, you know, when I'm at home and the alarm clock goes off, can't I just say the Zendo is in my mind?
Well, one thing.
Or, you know, I imagine that people are in Central Square of Cairo right now.
Yeah.
But that's totally in my mind.
And if you know it's in your mind.
My experience is only on NPR and
and you really think, but that's the difference. Do you see that it's just in my mind, or like, no, it really is happening in Cairo? That's the difference between. But if you say,
it's
I.
Cairo is different than what's in his mind. You have no realistic conception. Of course, and I can say yes, and I understand that. but of course, that's a perception. You know, that's something that it's concrete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm imagining when I'm in a big square, I'm imagining seeing fireworks with a lot of people.
So I think to say that there's no, when we say there's no Zendo, it's like there's no the Zendo that we think is here is not the one that's here. There's the Zendo in our mind. That's saying there is no, you know, definitive, fixed Zendo that, you know, it's really the same thing as saying, like, it's mere concept. We talked about in one of these earlier days that sometimes the realization in the mind-only school is sometimes called the realization of the non-duality of subject and object, or the realization that the external world is empty of the way we imagine it to be, which is kind of saying there's no Zendo. But sometimes, the school says, an equivalent version of this realization is the realization that all this is mere concept. So that came to mind when you were asking that actually it's the same realization, although it sounds quite different to say there is no external Zendo, or no, you know, Zendo existing independent of the mind, is saying that there's no, that's what it's meant by no Zendo, is the same as saying that Zendo is mere concept. Mere meaning like, it's not like a concept overlaid on the real Zendo. It's any Zendo we can relate to is merely a concept. So, I don't know if that points a little bit towards. So, yeah, one of them's more negative sounding, like there's no Zendo, and one of them's more positive, like there is the Zendo that's mere concept. So. Yeah. And if we put our finger on it, we're putting a finger on the mere concept of the Zendo. Like, we can do that. Yeah, this is the Zendo, but this is the mere concept of it. So,
so we can go positive or negative, but there's no, like, neutral other than Mu.
Mu is like, there's no Zendo. There's Mu Zendo. But yeah, there's more we could say about this. I think is somewhat important point that's gonna that the sutra gets into when it gets into these three characteristics of phenomena, which you might recall. because the sutra's approach is not to say that this is mere concept. It's coming more from the negating emptiness perspective. It's saying that it's the absence of our imagined projection of reality onto the soup. It's like the absence of the potatoes in the soup
is
what's called the thoroughly established character of phenomena in this system in chapter 6. But it's interesting because it's an absence, but it's called the thoroughly established character. You know, it's a negation, but it's and that's part of the unique play of the school, that I think is very intentional that they're doing this, and very juicy that they, you know, this is what makes it different from Nagarjuna's teaching of where they would just say it's empty, it's an emptiness. It actually, what they're talking about is emptiness in the mind-only school. It's called the thoroughly established character. And the sutra even says, and it exists in permanent time, in everlasting time. Whoa! Why? Buddha Dharma shouldn't sound like that, you know?
If you start from this phenomenal realm, and you attract to more subtle interpretations, and you finally realize that this is its true characteristic?
Thoroughly established true characteristic is, you know,
in the more subtle understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what that is ungraspability, there's, you know, inconceivability.
But something occurs. There's an object out there. And when you've retracted far enough from external input and see that object co-arises with my perception.
But any way we can possibly conceive of it is making it into something. So I think part of the trick here is that in using this kind of language, like thoroughly established, is it's very tricky and kind of dangerous, because it's tempting us to get a hold of it in some way.
What if you don't? Okay, so you develop.